You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here. American Family Insurance can help protect your dream home for whatever comes next. You can live in your own oasis or your own clubhouse. Whatever you choose, get the right coverage. Save up to 23% by bundling home and auto. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies. 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
The next best predictor of lifetime success is conscientiousness. Well, so, and of the two aspects of conscientiousness, say orderliness and industriousness, the better predictor is industriousness. So the question is, well, what can you do about your industriousness? And the answer to that is, well, that's kind of rough too, because there's a strong genetic component. But you can work on micro habits with regards to your conscientiousness. And I think the best micro habits, this is partly to do with this future authoring program processes, I think the best thing you can do with regards to your conscientiousness is to set up some aims for yourself, goals that you actually value. And the future authoring program helps people do that. And basically, it does a situational analysis of, it helps you do a situational analysis of your life more than a psychological analysis, I would say. And so the questions are something like, well, all right, you're going to have to put some effort into your life. And you need to be motivated to do that. And so what are the potential sources of motivation? Well, you could think about them in the big five manner. You know, if you're extroverted, you want friends. If you're agreeable, you want an intimate relationship. If you're disagreeable, you want to win competitions. If you're open, you want to engage in creative activity. If you're high in neuroticism, you want security. Okay, so those are all sources of potential motivation that you could draw on, that you could tailor to your own, you know, your own personality. But then there are dimensions that you want to consider your life across. And so we ask people about, well, you know, if you could have your life the way you wanted it in 3 to 5 years, if you were taking care of yourself properly, you know, what would you want from your friendships? What would you want from your intimate relationship? How would you like to structure your family? What do you want for your career? Well, how are you going to use your time outside of your job? And how are you going to regulate your mental and physical health, and maybe also your drug and alcohol use? Because that's a good place to auger down, you know, because alcoholism, for example, wipes out, you know, 5 to 10% of people. So you want to keep that under control. And then so maybe, you know, you develop a vision of what you would like your life to be, and that associates the goal. Well, once the goal is established, and then you break down the goal into micro processes that you can implement, the micro processes become rewarding in proportion, in relation to their causal association with the goal. And that tangles in your incentive reward system. You know, we talked about the dopaminergic incentive reward system, and that's the thing that keeps you moving forward. And the way it works is that it works better if it produces positive emotion when it can see you moving towards a valued goal. Okay, well, what's the implication of that? Better have a valued goal, because otherwise you can't get any positive motivation working out. And so the more valuable the goal, in principle, the more the micro processes associated with that goal start to take on a positive charge. And so what that means is, well, you get up in the morning and you're excited about the day, you're ready to go. And so as far as I can tell, what you do is you specify your long-term ideal. Maybe you also specify a place you want to stay the hell away from, so that you're terrified to fail as well as excited about succeeding, because that's also useful. You specify your goal. You do that in some sense as a unique individual. You want to specify goals that make you say, oh, if that could happen as a consequence of my efforts, it would clearly be worthwhile. Because the question always is, why do something? Because doing nothing is easy. You just sit there and you don't do anything. That's real easy. The question is, why would you ever do anything? And the answer to that has to be because you've determined by some means that it's worthwhile. And then the next question might be, well, where should you look for worthwhile things? And one would be, well, you could consult your own temperament. And the other would be, well, you kind of look at how Look at what it is that people accrue that's valuable across the lifespan. Look what, so you do a structural analysis of the subcomponents of human existence, and already did that. You need a family, you need friends. Like, you don't need to have all these things, but you better have most of them. Family, friends, career, educational goals, plans for, you know, time outside of work, attention to your mental and physical health, etc. You know, that's what life is about. And if you don't have any of those things, well, then all you've got left is misery and suffering. So that's a bad deal for you. So once you set up that goal structure, let's say, and that's really in many ways, that's what you should be doing at university. Is that's exactly what you should be doing, is trying to figure out who it is that you're trying to be, right? And you aim at that, and then you use everything you learn as a means of building that person that you want.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
And I really mean want to be. I don't mean should be, even those things are going to overlap. And it's important to distinguish between those, because that's partly, and this is back down to the micro-routine analysis. So if I was saying, well, you're going to try to make yourself more industrious. Okay, number one, specify your damn goals, because how are you going to hit something if you don't know what it is? That isn't going to happen. And often people won't specify their goals too, because they don't like to specify conditions for failure. So if you keep yourself all vague and foggy, which is real easy, because that's just a matter of not doing as well, then you don't know when you fail. And people might say, well, I really don't want to know when I fail, because that's painful. So I'll keep myself blind about when I fail. That's fine, except you'll fail all the time then. You just won't know it until you've failed so badly that you're done. And that can easily happen by the time you're 40. So I would recommend that you don't let that happen. So that's willful blindness, right? You could have known, but you chose not to. Okay, so once you get your goal structure set up, you think, okay, if I could have this life, looks like that might be worth living, despite the fact that it's going to be, you know, anxiety provoking and threatening, and there's going to be some suffering and loss involved in all of that. Obviously, the goal is to have a vision for your life such that, all things considered, that justifies your effort. Okay, so then what do you do? Well, then you turn down to the micro routines. It's like, okay, well, this is what I'm aiming for. How does that instantiate itself day to day, week to week, month to month? And that's where something like a schedule can be unbelievably useful. Google Calendar. It's like, make a damn schedule and stick to it. Okay, so what's the rule with a schedule? It's not a bloody prison. That's the first thing that people do wrong. They say, well, I don't like to follow a schedule. Well, it's like, well, what kind of schedule are you setting up? Well, I have to do this, then I have to do this, then I have to do this. You know, and then I just go play video games, because who wants to do all these things that I have to do? It's like, wrong. Set the damn schedule up so that you have the day you want. That's the trick. It's like, okay, I've got tomorrow. If I was going to set it up so it was the best possible day I could have, practically speaking, what would it look like? Well, then you schedule that. And obviously, there's a bit of responsibility that's going to go along with that, because if you have any sense, one of the things that you're going to insist upon is that at the end of the day, you're not in worse shape than you were than at the beginning of the day, right? Because that's a stupid day. If you have a bunch of those in a row, you just dig, you know, you dig yourself a hole and then you bury yourself in it. It's like, sorry, that's just not a good strategy. It's a bad strategy. So maybe 20% of your day has to be responsibility and obligation, or maybe it's more than that, depending on how far behind you are. But even that, you can ask yourself, okay, well, I've got these responsibilities. I have to schedule the damn things in. What's the right ratio of responsibility to reward? And you can ask yourself that, just like you'd negotiate with someone who is working for you. It's like, okay, you got to work tomorrow. Okay, so I want you to work tomorrow. And you might say, okay, well, what are you going to do for me that makes it likely that I'll work for you? Well, you could ask yourself that, you know. So maybe you do an hour of responsibility and then you play a video game for 15 minutes. I don't know, whatever turns your crank, man. But, you know, you have to negotiate with yourself and not tyrannize yourself. Like you're negotiating with someone that you care for, that you would like to be productive and have a good life. And that's how you make the schedule. It's like, and then you look at the day and you think, well, if I had that day, that'd be good. Great. You know, and you're useless and horrible, so you'll probably only hit it with about 70% accuracy, but that beats the hell out of zero, right? And if you hit it even with 50% accuracy, another rule is, well, aim for 51% the next week, or 50.5% for God's sake, or because you're going to hit that position where things start to loop back positively and spiral you upward. And so that's one way that you can work on your conscientiousness, is plan a life you'd like to have. And you do that partly by referring to social norms. That's more or less rescuing your father from the belly of the whale. But the other way you do that is by having a little conversation with yourself about, as if you don't really know who you are, because you know what you're like. You won't do what you're told. You won't do what you tell yourself to do. You must have noticed that. It's like you're a bad employee and a worse boss. And both of those work, you know, for you. You don't know what you want to do. And then when you tell yourself what to do, you don't do it anyways. You should fire yourself and find someone else to be. But you know, my point is that you have to understand that you're not your own servant, so to speak. You're someone that you have to negotiate with. And you're someone that you want to present the opportunity of having a good life to. And that's hard for people because they don't like themselves very much. So, you know, they're always like cracking the whip and then procrastinating and cracking the whip and then procrastinating. And it's like, God, it's so boring and such a pathetic way of spending your time. And you know what that's like because you probably waste like 6 hours a day. And I think we did an economic calculation about that a while back, right? Your time's probably worth $50 an hour, something like that. I mean, you're not getting paid that now, but you're young. And so this is investment time. And what you do now is going to multiply its effects in the future. So let's say it's $50 an hour, which is perfectly reasonable. So if you waste 6 hours a day, and you are, then you're wasting about $2,000 a week or about $100,000 a year. So like, go ahead, but that's what it's costing you every hour. And you need to know what your damn time is worth. So let's say it's not $50, it's 30, whatever. Maybe it's 100, it's somewhere in that range. One of the things you should be asking yourself is, when you spend an hour, was that, well, what have I paid someone $50 to have had that hour? And if the answer is no, it's like, well, maybe you should do something else with your time. And it depends on whether or not you think that your time's worthwhile. But the funny thing about not assuming that is if you assume your time isn't worthwhile, what happens is you don't just sit around sort of randomly in a state of responsibility-less bliss. What you do is you suffer existentially. And so that seems like a stupid solution. So anyways... As far as I can tell, that's how you can improve your conscientiousness. Outline a goal that you actually would like to hit. And even better, here's something else you can think about when you're negotiating in your life. You could say, if you're kind of pessimistic, you'd say, well, we have to negotiate an agreement. I'd like to walk away not miserable and resentful. Okay, let's call that a baseline. And that's how you're going to negotiate with your wife or your husband. That's a good thing to know. You want to negotiate so that you don't walk away miserable and resentful, because that makes you hostile and then you'll work to hurt them. And I would say that's unless you want to hurt them, and then of course they'll happily return the favor. If you want to exist in a place where you're basically hitting each other in the head repeatedly for 30 years, you go right ahead. But I wouldn't say that that's a particularly good way of living. So you might say, well, the minimal precondition for a successful negotiation is that you don't walk away resentful and angry. And so that's also how you know when you have something to say to someone. Because the rule has to be, if you're going to walk away resentful and angry, you've got something to say. Doesn't mean you're right, by the way. But it does mean that you have something to say. But it's kind of a low bar, you know. Like, if I wanted to live with you for 30 years, maybe we should say, how about we walk away from our mutual negotiations thrilled? Well, why not? You know, you got to aim for something. You could aim for that. You want to negotiate with your boss for a new salary. You might think, okay, I've got this damn job. How much would I have to be paid so I'd be so bloody excited to go to work I could hardly stand it? Well, you could at least know what that number is. And then you could go there and say, well, look, you know, You like to have me around? I've been doing some thinking. I think if you paid me this amount of money, I'd be so thrilled to go to work that you could hardly even keep me away from here. And your boss might think, wow, I'd actually really like to have someone around who'd be so thrilled to work that I can't get rid of them. It's like, maybe I'll, well, I can't give you all of that. I'll give you 75%. Maybe we can renegotiate it in a year. It's like, hey, good deal. Or you can, you know, be some weaselly coward and go in there and snivel about how awful your life is and walk away barely able to tolerate the outcome of the negotiation. It's like, I wouldn't recommend that. And it's funny because I've watched people do this repeatedly in my clinical practice because we plan all the time because the rule is you're going to come and see me. I'm going to try to help you figure out how to have the life that you want to have. And we're going to think about that strategically. So you're making $50,000 a year right now. Maybe you should be making $150,000 in 3 years. And they think, well, that couldn't happen. It's like, not with that attitude. That's the first thing. It's like, no, that's not going to happen. If you don't ask people for the damn money, if you don't look for a better job, but they're going to come along and just shovel a boat full of money at you. It's like, no, that's not going to happen. But why is that impossible? Look at you people in here. It's like, what the hell is wrong with you? Nothing. So you can probably have what you want if you could figure out what the hell it was, and then, you know, you diligently pursued it. So, and then maybe you wouldn't whine about being alive. That'd be good, because people who whine about being alive are dangerous to themselves and other people. So you might think, I can have what I want, but you better well figure out what it is. And you can't just wait for the, like, have what you want fairy to show up at your doorstep and grant it, because obviously that's not going to happen. So okay, conscientiousness. Well, we talked about how you could improve that. Social networking. That's another big deal. It's one of the advantages that older people have over younger people. And so, for example, now that I'm in my 50s, roughly speaking, I know a bunch of other people who are, you know, relatively well positioned in the dominance hierarchy, and they know all sorts of people. And so when I go to one of them and say, you know, can you do X or do you know X? They say, no, but I know someone who can. And that's a huge advantage. So another thing that you want to think about as you move through life, and this is that use your ability to network properly. And that doesn't mean schmooze, and it doesn't mean go out and impress people. That's all just complete bloody rubbish. It means you try to surround yourself with people who are competent in multiple different dimensions, and you maintain your relationships with them. And that's a trading relationship too, right? It involves reciprocity. But it's a huge advantage. A social network is a huge advantage, and that's something extroverted people can be really good at, because, you know, they have that sort of social ability. And that goes along with the ability to sell. So another place that you can pick up power, and power for the good, for the right things, is to consciously develop and maintain your social networks. And that also means, well, let's talk about friendships for a minute. Here's how you know if someone's your friend. A, you can tell them bad news and they'll listen. They won't tell you why, you know, you're stupid and why that bad thing happened to you and how something worse happened to them once and, you know, derail the whole conversation. You can actually tell them bad news and they'll listen. So that's a good thing. And then this is a weirder thing. You can tell them good news and they'll help you celebrate. And that's a really good way of deciding who you should have around you. Because if you have someone around you, you know, something good happens to you and you're kind of afraid to even admit it because, you know, God, something good happened to you. It's like that, you let that be known and it'll certainly be taken away. So, you know, you come out and you sort of tell someone half-heartedly that something good happened to you. And they give you a whack and then talk about, you know, the great thing that happened to them 3 years ago, or worse, the great thing that happened to someone that they knew 3 years ago. You know, it's like, go away from that person. They're not helpful to you, and they're not helpful to themselves either. And so you want to surround yourself. You got to think about this. You got to surround yourself with people who want the best for the best part of you. You can hang around with weasels and losers that are trying to pull you down to justify the fact that they're spiraling downhill as well. And you know, the upside of that is you don't have to have any responsibility, and you can all whine about how wretched life is, you know, so that's pretty attractive. But I would say it's also a bad medium to long-term plan. And so it's acceptable and desirable to try to surround yourself with people who are facilitating your development. You know, and you might say, well, I've got people around, I know them well, you know, they're not doing that well, and they don't fit into that category. It's like, what's your point? What are you going to do with them exactly? If they'll listen and cooperate with you and move towards a better future, great. If they don't pay any attention and they keep doing the same damn things over and over and they're not going anywhere and it's painful, then maybe the proper thing to do is say, you just have your misery. I'll go off and have my life. And maybe you'll wake up at some point in the future and think that's a better way of being. Because just putting up with it is, well, they call that enabling, right? You put up with that sort of behavior, you're providing tacit consent for it and even tacit approval. It's like, it's a bad idea. You have, I would say, both the right and the responsibility to surround yourself with people who are good for the best part of you. And that's not the same as, you know, I don't have to elaborate on that. You can figure out what that means. Skills, that's another thing you can do if you want to increase your probability of success. Every time you have an opportunity to take an opportunity that would provide you with a new skill, do it, right? Learn to program, learn to write, learn to read new things, learn to public speak, learn how to introduce yourself to people, learn how to social network, learn how to go talk to your boss in a manner, this is the right way to go talk to someone who's supervising you. I see this problem, and here's a solution, and so I'm coming to talk to you about the problem and the solution. It's like, that person is going to want to talk to you a lot. It's like, because the other people they're talking to are going to come and say, I've got a problem. Can you do something about it? It's like, they don't want to do something about it. They already got 50 things to do, you know? So if you're the person who constantly brings forth a problem, even if they're accurate problems, is why are they going to want to have you around? You're just another problem. Don't be a problem for the people who want to give you money. That's a good rule of thumb, man. You know, if someone wants to give you money, then help them do that. And if they want to give you status and success, then help them do that, right? And you do that in part by bringing them solutions. And partly you do that by developing your skills. And so if things aren't going very well for you, this is also a good way of evaluating an opportunity. Should you take an opportunity? Well, here's the rule. Take the opportunity if it will teach you something that you can use for other opportunities. Because then even if it fails, which it probably will, it doesn't matter because you've accrued something of value that you can bring forward to the next situation. So, you know, there's this old Jungian idea that I told you about in the Chartres Cathedral, for example. The cathedral is made in the form of a cross, and the cross signifies the center of the world, and the dome signifies the sky. And so right below the dome at the center of the world, and it's a cross because the cross is the place of suffering, so that's the center of the world, because that's what you are. You're the place of suffering, right? You're the place of conscious suffering. That's the center of the world. And so inscribed on the floor is a maze, and it's a big maze, and it's a mandala, and there's a kind of a flower-shaped resting place right in the center. And what you're doing is walking in the maze, and you walk all four quadrants, and you get to the middle, which is where you want to be. You want to be in the middle. Well, how do you get there? You walk everywhere. And what does that mean? It means every bloody time you're offered an opportunity, take it and develop your skills. And that's better than wealth, by the way. In fact, it actually constitutes wealth, because wealth constitutes what you have when someone takes all your money away, right? That's real wealth. And so the way that you build up that sort of wealth is you turn yourself into someone who's competent in multiple directions. And you can be doing that all the time, right? Especially with the kind of technology that you people have access to. I mean, you can learn anything you want whenever you want. So what a good deal that is, man. And so there's easy fruit hanging that you could pick. And I would recommend that you do that. So here's an example. Let's say you're not doing too bad. So maybe you're in the middle of the normal distribution. Then you lose your job. Okay, and so, and let's say you're a conscientious person. And we could say, just for the sake of argument, that you lose your job because of mass layoffs in your company. So it has nothing to do with you. It's fundamentally, it's just like luck of the draw, basically. But then what happens to you? Well, if you're conscientious, you're gonna go after yourself pretty hard. So you're going to, and especially if you're also high in neuroticism, it's going to depress you to lose your job. And maybe you're in a situation where you just, for one reason or another, you don't have that many other opportunities. Now, maybe you should have looked for them, but maybe you're in a depressed strata of the economy, or you're geographically located somewhere that makes moving difficult, or so on and so forth, you know. So, but you lose your job, and then you start to get depressed because of that. Well, then as you start to get depressed, you know, it decreases the probability that you're going to look for a job, but it also maybe starts to put stress on your family, and it also starts to decrease the probability that you're going to engage in positive social interaction. So now not only are you unemployed and suffering from economic stress, but your marriage is starting to suffer and you're starting to isolate yourself from your friends. And then, of course, as your marriage suffers and the stress builds up, then that's going to make you more depressed, and that's going to keep you even farther away from your friends, and that's going to decrease the likelihood that you're going to have enough positive emotion and enthusiasm to look for another job. And then, you know, maybe you want to add a bit of a drinking problem to that just for fun, and you can see that you can get a spiral going that's just taken you down, right? And it's all sorts of things, because lots of times people conceptualize, let's say, you know, you're an unemployed guy and you go to counseling and you get a diagnosis of depression. And the thing about a diagnosis of depression, it's sort of like the assumption is there's something gone wrong with your psychological structure. It's like, if you're unemployed and you're depressed, it isn't obvious at all that the problem is in your head. You know what I mean? It isn't even obvious that it's a psychological problem. It's just a problem, and problems can take you out. And so, if you're unemployed and you're under economic stress and your marriage is starting to shake and you're isolating yourself from your friends and you're less likely to be motivated to go look for a job, you can sort of think about that as a depressive spiral, but you can also think of it as a conspiracy, in some sense, of external forces that are augering you into the ground. And we don't tend to conceptualize psychological disorders that way, but we should, because lots of times when people are suffering from something that you could describe in psychological terminology, and depression is a very good example of that, it isn't obvious that there's something wrong with them psychologically. Often, they just are in trouble. And there isn't a category in psychological diagnosis for client in serious trouble. But my experience has been almost without exception that the people that come to see me because something's gone wrong with their life, not because they have a psychological problem. Now you could say, well, their psychological inadequacies, such as they might be, are interfering with their ability to recover, or maybe even served as precursors to, you know, increase the probability of the catastrophe. But it's still not exactly the appropriate way to conceptualize it. And, you know, because there's you inside you, and as a personality psychologist and as a clinical theorist, most of what I've talked to you guys about is your psyche and its structure as if it was like a soul that inhabited you. And there's some real utility in that. You know, you're an individual demarcated from the community. You can be set up in a healthy manner or a non-healthy manner. The problem with that is that you're not just an individual. You're connected to all these external network, dynamic networks that are really, really important. And it isn't even easy to separate them from you. You know, like you might say, well, this is especially true once you become a parent, is like, is your child more you than your arm? You know, well, you think it's pretty obvious that parts of you that are physically linked are more key to you as an entity, but it's by no means obvious. I think many people would much more happily sacrifice an arm than a child, you know, and so your boundaries are not, where your boundaries are located are not precisely isomorphic with the outline of your body. It's not that simple at all, and so you're embedded in all sorts of networks that can pull you down rapidly or elevate you, because the other thing that happens is that, well, let's say I've never traded with anyone, and I go up to someone and I say, well, do you want to trade? And they say, well, how can I trust you? And the answer to that is, well, you have to take my word for it. Well, that's not a very good argument. You might say instead, well, here's what I have to offer, and you can evaluate it. But the person is likely to say, well, I don't know how to evaluate it, and so I'm still stuck with taking your word. So that's a bad problem. And you'll see that if you ever try to sell a product in the marketplace, is if you don't, if the product is new and it's complex, then you're forcing the person that wants to buy it to evaluate it, and then you're forcing them to take the risk of being wrong as well as the time it would take to evaluate it, and they don't like that. What they want is what's often called social proof, which is, okay, well, you want to trade with me, who else have you traded with? And if the answer is zero, then they are going to say, well, you're an interesting person and all that, but I've got these other people over here who've already traded with a bunch of people, and therefore the risk is lower, in part because, let's say, I have a supervisor and I'm going to make a decision. And my primary concern is that my supervisor will not hate me for making the decision. It's not that my primary concern is to make the best decision. It's not the same thing. It's that I want to make a decision that I'm not going to get in trouble for. Okay, so how do I do that? Because I need a post hoc justification. So I buy something from you and it turns out to be terrible. And I get called on the table for it. And what do I say? I say, well, you know, that person was buying from it, and that person was buying from him, and that person was buying from him. Like, all these other people were doing the same thing, so it's not like the error is localized in me, and that's often a very credible story. But if the answer is, well, you know, I evaluated it and decided to take a risk, it's like, well, out the door with you, Sonny, because, you know, that's an indication that you're not capable of doing that sort of thing. So I think part of the reason that people spiral downhill into zero is because positive feedback, like a positive feedback loop, is a loop that increases the probability that the loop will continue, right? A positive feedback loop is, you've experienced this when you hear microphone feedback in an amplified system. So, you know, the microphone sends a message to the speakers, and then the speakers send out the message amplified, and then the microphone picks up the message and it gets amplified again, and you get this howling occur, which can be deafening, but can also destroy the system because it'll keep amplifying upward until the speakers blow, for example. That's a positive feedback loop. And a positive feedback loop can spiral you upward or it can spiral you downward. And so a virtuous circle, a virtuous positive feedback loop is when, well, I've traded with him and I've traded with him and I've traded with him, and now I can say to you, I've traded with these three people, and you go talk to them and they say good things, and so then you say, well, I'll trade with you, and then because of that, then you're even more likely to trade with me, and it's like the thing starts to spiral uphill, and it does that, I think, in a nonlinear form. And so, because one of the things you guys are going to be asking yourself as you mature, because what's happening is that income inequality is increasing, right? And you might ask, well, why is that? The first thing you need to know is that that's what income does. So it's not like you need an explanation for it. This is the explanation. It's like a natural rule. If you run a trading game to its logical conclusion, one person ends up with all the money and everyone else ends up with zero.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Hey, Drew and Jonathan Scott here. Build a customized renter's policy with American Family Insurance so you can protect your tandem bike on the go. Thief! Oh, he is struggling with that two-seater. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at amfam.com.
Some exclusions may apply. Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies. 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.